pocket to the shores of Orange Beach and all points in between. An insider's perspective on Alabama politics. It's the Jeff Poor Show.
I don't think Hank done it this way.
Welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5. So I got to be careful I don't say the wrong call letters when you go from station to station. There's just a muscle memory that kicks in. And I get ready just right on the edge to say it, but then I steer the ship in the right direction and remind everybody to listen to FM Talk 106.5, second day of the program here. So glad you could be with us. At the bottom of the hour, we'll be joined by State Representative Chip Brown at studio. Looking forward to that. Don't believe I may have sat in with him with Sean once before, but it'll be good to get to know him and talk about some things, local politics and a little local economy and whatnot. Coming up tomorrow on the program, we got from the Heritage Foundation, Hanavance McCaskey. We're talking about mail-in balloting, mail-in elections. You know, that thing with the push for mail, vote by mail and all that. We have some forms of that. Absentee ballots obviously are a mail-in sort of system, but the way many Democrats, this is how they want it. They want to go to the voter rolls and just automatically mail out ballots, which just seems like you're setting up for some kind of disaster. Well, I talked to Lars Bukowski about that tomorrow. Also on the program, looking forward to talking to State Senator David Sessions. He'll be with us. And what will be a Wednesday regular guest on this program from Yellowhammer News, Sean Ross will be with us. So make sure that you tune in for that. Just going to give you a rundown of some headlines talked about a little earlier in case you weren't listening. Tommy Tuberville up 17 points over Doug Jones, according to a Morning Consult poll. I said this earlier, and I think this remains to be true. The polls, what polling there was in head-to-head matchups with Tommy Tuberville and Doug Jones back during the primary was a lot tighter. And why was that? Well, you could attribute that to these candidates were beating up on one another. You had Jeff Sessions running negative ads about Tommy Tuberville. You had Tommy Tuberville going after Bradley Byrne. Bradley Byrne in the mix back then when the last head-to-head matchup poll. They did these hypothetical matchups. Who would be the best opponent for Doug Jones? And they were all closer than what you would think. But now you don't have that fighting within the party. You don't have that circular firing squad. It's going to allow the Republican nominee, which in this case is Coach Tuberville, to rise and build up a little bit of a lead. I still think that gap is going to widen. Now, there could be some unforeseen things come along, or they call it the October surprise, or things of that nature could come along. But I think if things go on this trajectory, that gap widens. Trump at the top of the ballot is a lot to overcome. But in addition to that, straight ticket voting in Alabama. That is very difficult to overcome, too. So Tuberville, a big, big favorite in that early on. Also, Biden VP, we're getting closer and closer to that. I said this earlier, I think Susan Rice is on the rise. Yes, Deep State Susan, someone referred to her as on the text line. These candidates are getting their moment in the sun, these potential VP candidates. And I think they're getting tested by the media. The media are doing a service for Joe Biden. We're getting to see them in these interview situations with Rachel Maddow or Chris Hayes or Don Lemon, Anderson Cooper. And they're making the rounds on the morning shows, Today Show, Morning Joe. How are they handling this round robin of interviews? That scrutiny, that's part of it. You don't get that. The Republicans don't get that luxury. But the Democrats are getting that. We saw it with Stacey Abrams. We saw it with Tammy Duckworth. We saw it a lot with Tammy Duckworth. We're seeing it now with Susan Rice. I suspect maybe you might get one more go at it. But with the date of the convention, which I guess is going to be something virtual looming, that announcement ought to be forthcoming real soon. If it's not, you know, that's one you got to watch out for because it will creep up on us out of nowhere. It's sort of like how, if you recall, and I was trying to think back when Pence and Biden were named Trump and Obama's running mates respectively, when did that happen? And it started leaking out on a Friday, and then the official announcement came on a Saturday. And do we see that all over again? Sarah Palin kind of came midweek, if I recall. Sarah Palin, very consequential in that election because, if you recall, Sarah Palin, John McCain had just kind of a very mediocre campaign all around from beginning to end. But the only signs of life we really saw was when he named Sarah Palin his running mate. If you recall, Biden was way behind early on. They thought he was done. We thought it was going to be Mike Huckabee or Mitt Romney or somebody. But then McCain comes, and he has a strong showing in Iowa, finishes second, then wins the New Hampshire primary. Next thing you know, it's over. He is the nominee. But then that campaign just struggles. The baggage of the Bush administration, the baggage of the financial collapse, all of that made it very tough for McCain to get any traction. But then he named Sarah Palin his running mate. And that's when that campaign really took off. And they started they got close. They got within the margin of error to Barack Obama and Joe Biden in that 2008 election. But then the financial collapse happens. And McCain is caught flat-footed. The Democrats come in with a plan, Nancy Pelosi, and they allow Barack Obama to lead the charge. And then it was all academic after that. It was it wasn't a landslide, but it was a wipeout. But had it not been for Sarah Palin, it wouldn't have been as close as it was. So I think the running mate can make a difference if it is chosen wisely. Now, we were talking to Dan Gaynor in that last segment, or the last hour. He thinks the default candidate is what he said was Kamala Harris. She probably is. But I would say the default candidate all along was Joe Biden. We seem to go to the defaults. We seem to be playing it safe with the Democrats. When I say we, I mean generally. They seem to be, not that I'm a Democrat, but they seem to be playing it safe. It is whatever you got to do to beat Donald Trump. Don't take any risky chances. Don't try a trick play like a Sarah Palin move. Don't do anything like that. What's the safest pick? And you look at this slate. Well, they all got their pros and cons. But I think the safe pick, the smart pick, was probably Kamala Harris, Senator Harris, the junior senator from California. I know Duckworth would be outside the box. That might be your Hail Mary pick. A war veteran from a state that could go either way in a presidential election, red or blue. I think that's a risky pick. We don't know how she will act under all that public scrutiny. We know how Kamala Harris can act. We saw it on the debate stage. She'll have to correct or amend her remarks about Joe Biden being a racist or being for busing. Remember that controversy? That will have to be adjusted for the record. But I think it's nothing that can't be overcome. But that, if you look at the Democratic Party right now, and while all the energy is on that far, far left, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and her ilk, there is the establishment of Democratic Party is reluctant to embrace that movement. They know that, yes, that's the base. That's where all the people that are going to put out yard signs be very active in the campaign. But it comes at a price. It comes at a potential price, I should say, of really ostracizing the middle of America. Because that's outside the mainstream. We start talking about socialism. Remember when you were a kid? Socialism, communism, those are bad words. We're in the middle of the Cold War. We don't want to be like the Soviet Union. We're America, by golly. We believe in capitalism and American pie. Socialism, what's that? Even though we do have some socialist, I would say, entitlement programs, the idea that you could be openly socialist and win in a national election is very tough. I still think we're some time away from that. We may be trending in that direction, guys. Demographic shifts. Just the attitude, the public schools, and the way they are teaching people, and they're teaching this as a virtue. It may come eventually, but right now, it is a little premature to think that the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's, the Bernie Sanders types, are really going to be mainstream candidates in the United States of America. And Democrats know that. That's what they think, and they're reluctant to go in that direction. Because if Joe Biden is down in this race to Donald Trump, I think maybe he takes it in that direction. I think to get the base activated. Remember, the problem for Republicans was always getting the base really engaged for, what was it, Bob Dole? Who's excited about Bob Dole? Who's excited about Mitt Romney or John McCain? So you bring on a Sarah Palin. Or for whatever reason, if you're Mitt Romney, bring on Paul Ryan. But you bring on somebody you think is kind of exciting. Well, Democrats, you talk to them. You listen to James Carville talk. You listen to these. They think they got this thing won. They think it is over. Don't do anything stupid. Don't take any risky gambles. You go with the safest bet, and you're going to win in November. What's the safest play right now? And the safest play to me, from my advantage point, seems like it could be Susan Rice, but the safer play is probably a sitting United States Senator and Kamala Harris. Only problem with Kamala Harris, she doesn't bring a whole lot to the table in the form of geographic politics. She's from California. California always goes Democrat. It's gone Democrat ever since, what, 1984? And that presidential election, Reagan versus Mondale. But she seems to be the safe play. I think she has some vulnerabilities. Will Republicans be able to exploit those? Will it be a big deal? You know, what's the question you always ask? Are you ready? You're a heartbeat away from the presidency. Could people see her as president of the United States? And does that really matter in the calculus and trying to think of who you would vote for president? Or does it do this? Does it maybe get some other people that otherwise might not be, you know, active in politics? Does it get them out to vote? Does it make them want to go to the polls and vote for this person? Not in California, but wherever. Does she appeal to suburban soccer moms or whatever? Maybe she does. Time will tell, but I think she's the safe pick. And that's why I think they're going to go in that direction right now. I am very bullish on Susan Rice, however. I think she's also, and forget, she's got a lot of vulnerabilities. But the way the Democrats have handled that, it's just crazy Republicans in their tinfoil hats and conspiracy theories. That's the way Obama handled it. Benghazi, Republicans totally mishandled the Benghazi episode. We thought that was going to be what took down Obama, right? Remember that? Or took down Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State. She's got to answer for this. And then we bring in Trey Gowdy, who's just this master prosecutor. And you get these kind of like tiresome, tedious hearings. People lose interest after 15 minutes. And then time goes on, and then it just didn't work the way it was supposed to work, guys. And if they try to relitigate that, if she is named the nominee, they try to relitigate that, they better have a better game plan than they had back in 2016 or 2015. With Benghazi, but that's one of the drawbacks for Susan Rice. That just makes me think Kamala Harris has probably got the edge on everybody. It's the safe play. It's the way that you know, we don't blow this, don't mess this up, and the Democrats ought to win the presidency, and we can get back to normal and restore law and order, and all will be right with the world. One thing I'll say real quick before we go to break. Whoever wins this presidential election, be it Biden or Joe Biden, the party out of power is going to have a big 2022. And that's going to impact our politics here at Alabama. But we could talk more about that as the show unfolds, because I think that kind of guides the direction of the Republican Party here in Alabama, and maybe just what kind of candidates show up to will do well on that ballot. But more on that in a moment. All right, guys, going to take a quick break. We will return. This is FM Talk 106.5.
Living on the road, my friend, was gonna keep you free and clean.
Hear Richard Best picking on that red guitar, so get around.
Welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show at FM Talk 106.5. So good to be with you today on this Tuesday afternoon. Well, I guess it's Tuesday morning, depending on the time zone here. I get them. I my balance gets thrown off all the time. But so good to be with you nonetheless. Coming up in the next segment, we'll be joined by State Representative Chip Brown. He's going to join us in studio. Looking forward to that. What else we talk about here today? So 33,000 laptops are somewhere lost along the way on the way to Alabama. This is the problem with this home virtual learning in this era of COVID-19. That we're, you know, if we just had more rural broadband, if we just had more internet, all we need is that, and these kids can learn from in school. It'd be just like they're there in school, sitting in front of a laptop. Well, it's not that, I guess, on paper that would work, but we know human nature. We know how children are. My gosh, if I were sitting there in third grade and I was told to sit in front of a computer, I'd be playing with my Legos or something. So how do you police it? That's why schools, it's imperative for schools to get open back up. But the 33,000 laptops, the state ordered laptops from abroad. I guess they got a good deal on them. They haven't gotten here in time. They're not going to be here in time for school. I tell you what, you go try to buy a laptop somewhere right now. With all these people working from home now, and they've gone out, there's a run of laptops. Like, I think there's a run of laptops, particularly for school systems now trying to get back, especially if they're low-cost laptops. It's not that we make laptops in America. It'd probably be a very expensive endeavor. But you got to have those laptops to do all this virtual learning that we're told is necessary in the time of COVID-19. But here's my worry. The long-term implications of this is, you know, the teachers union and all of that, they want to go with the learning from home and the virtual learning. They don't want to be in a classroom with, they don't want their membership to be in a classroom with students that they could get the COVID-19. And, you know, how are we going to possibly enforce these safety guidelines and these protocols? How is that even going to work? No one really knows. We think for that reason we are better off not doing school just yet. Let's wait. But this goes on, and let's say this vaccine doesn't work like it's supposed to. It'll be a system where the haves, they can hire a teacher and do small learning sessions with their kids or whatever, and they'll be okay. They will teach their kids the proper skills and the necessary things they need to move on with life. That will happen. Have-nots won't have that opportunity. They won't have that luxury. It's almost like feudalism is coming back to the United States of America with education. But you get behind on that stuff, then you put yourself at a disadvantage when you're trying to compete with the rest of the world. Or even here in Alabama, you put yourself at a disadvantage against other states. Now, conversely, I think these other states aren't quite as eager to get back to normal order, particularly with schools. But remember, schools do so much more than educate kids. They serve as, nutrition for a lot of people in Alabama. But, you know, other than that, daycare. If you've got to go to work and your job's, you know, everything's open back up, what are you going to do with your children? If you just stay home with them, you can't do that. How are you going to figure all that out? So these schools play a very, very vital role in society. But when you talk to our policymakers, it's not really clear what measures are in place or what you can do to overcome these challenges, these obstacles. But that has broad long-term implications that we'll have to deal with. I think we'll have to deal with this whole episode in history for quite some time and getting caught back up. It may take a whole decade if we finally do get through this to where we are back where we were circa 2019, late 2019. But you're going to remember this, and we're going to, Congress has already dumped $3 trillion into this. There'll be more. There could be more bureaucracy. All we need is more bureaucracy, a Department of Health, that is, Health and Human Services, that's going to have its budget grow. We're going to have a whole a wing of their headquarters in Washington, D.C., or wherever it is, dedicated to infectious diseases, to pandemics, to stopping the spread of pandemics, to vaccine research. It's going to, you know, that is going to be the concern in our politics for Americans. You look at the polling right now, what are you most concerned with? And COVID-19 comes up number one. So every politician is going to have a 12-point plan to deal with this. And with that, we'll get some, you know, all kinds of congressional action. And it just grows government even more. But that's what the public demands. That's what they shall get. That's kind of how we operate. And that's my thinking. I don't know what that's going to look like, if it's going to trample on any freedoms or liberties. But rest assured, guys, it's coming. All right, we're going to take a break. We will return. This is FM Talk 106.5.
Jokes keep me feeling fine. And there's always a stage and a beautiful babe.
Chihuahua is my Everest, and the Coosa is my now. Alabama's where I was born and raised.
Welcome back to the Jeff Porter Show on FM Talk 106.5. 36 minutes after the hour on this Tuesday afternoon. Coming up tomorrow on the program from the Heritage Foundation, Hans Spakowski will be with us. We also got State Senator David Sessions joined us, and what will be a regular feature on Wednesdays is Yellowhammer News' Sean Ross. He'll be with us, so make sure that you tune in for that. Joining us now, however, I'm very excited to introduce my next guest. He is serves the fine folks in District 105. State Representative Chip Brown joins us on air. Representative, how are you today?
I'm doing great, Jeff. Thank you. It's great to be with you. I'm excited about your new show down here in Mobile.
Yeah, hopefully it all goes well. It's a work in progress, but I'm feeling pretty good about it. The real sucker here is Sean Sullivan for actually putting me behind a microphone here. I don't know what he was thinking, but we'll keep that between you and I. So how are things?
Doing great. We're in uncertain, uncharted times, of course, with the COVID situation going on, national elections, and in my district, in District 105, we have two elections today, actually. We've got two votes for, in Grand Bay, we have a vote dealing with increasing the fire district fees, and then also in Fowl River have a vote today on increasing the fire district fees.
Well, that, stuff like that's very, very important. I always wonder, though, you look at those elections and maybe you could kind of tell, are people willing to come out to the polls and see, you know, because there's all that fear right now about, you know, COVID-19, obviously. But these are important, not just because of what they do and what they mean to the community, but it's also, I think, a good kind of indicator of kind of how the public feels about stuff.
Well, that's true. And, you know, those fire districts do such a great job. In District 105, we only have two cities. We have the town of Dauphin Island and the city of Bilobattery, and the rest of it is unincorporated areas along the bay, and then Grand Bay, and up in Irvington, and those are totally reliant on volunteer fire departments. So this is, you know, they rely on a fee that you pay on your property taxes, and so that's how they operate. They don't get money from the cities because there's no
sales tax that's being collected, so you have to figure out how to get that money other way. So most people wouldn't think of your house district as a rural district, but it largely is.
Yeah, it really is. I touch the city of Mobile. The only thing that I have that's in the city of Mobile is Grand Point Apartments that are best spot of any apartment around. It's right on Dog River in Mobile Bay. Yeah. And that's in the city, but everything else is not. It's all county, and I don't see it changing.
Well, it's certainly been that way a while. Let's talk about how are things going in your district. We talk about, I mean, the economy for South Mobile County is much different than anywhere else in the state, I think. It's got a little bit of everything: bedroom community, agriculture, obviously seafood, a big deal, tourist economy. How is that all shaping up?
Well, you know, on the tourism side, right now Dauphin Island is really doing well. I mean, you know, people pent up not being able to travel for so long that the rental market is doing well. Restaurants are open. They had some staffing issues there for a while. Of course, all restaurants are having those problems across the country. But the economy down there is really rocking and rolling. And seafood industry took some hits, of course, but all that is starting to bounce back. And they need a lot of help with deregulation and preventing imports from China and that sort of thing on the shrimping side. But agriculture is the same way. I mean, people have to eat. And, they were affected by a lot of the restaurants closing, of course. But I would say things are picking up for sure.
Well, let's talk about that China element, because, right now there is this push nationally to kind of decouple the U.S. economy and China. And I think this is like, we don't import a whole lot of food, but what we do from China tends to be seafood, I guess. That seems to be a very big deal, very big issue, because of the way these markets, these prices are determined, that trying to figure out, put up some kind of barrier, I don't even know whatever you would call a barrier or whatnot, but that it's safer to eat local and get it from sources here domestically.
Well, that's definitely true. I mean, you know, a lot of your shrimp imports are from Vietnam, China, South America, that sort of thing. And at least, when you buy local, when you buy Alabama seafood, you know what you're getting. You're getting right. Shrimp from the Gulf, and it's the same shrimp that you would buy from the guy that has a pickup truck parked on the side of the road selling it out of a cooler. You're helping the local economy. You're helping those people that are relying on the seafood industry for their livelihood that spans generations going back. And I think it's important. I always encourage restaurants to buy local, to buy their seafood from Alabama seafood producers. And, when you look for that when you go into a market, also look for American-made, well, not American-made, but American package produced shrimp, or seafood, fish as well.
But the restaurant industry, its struggles with the shutdown, that had to take a toll on the seafood industry there.
It did. It sure did. Because it kind of hit right at the wrong time, right during the middle of the season, and so that's starting to come back. People are going out. My wife and I went out last night to a Mexican restaurant in Theodore, and it was packed. On a Monday night, and I think people just want to get out and want to buy and want to exercise their rights. Now we've had. Of course, the flip side of the pandemic, of course, is the unemployment issue. We've had a serious rise in unemployment, and that's the bulk of the calls that I get. I actually, for the last several months, have been unemployment calls go along with the normal veterans calls and Medicaid issues and that sort of thing. But unemployment's still a major issue in the way that the state has handled that.
Well, we had the mayor of Orange Beach on yesterday. He's talking about the difficulty in finding workers for those seasonal jobs. Do you have that dynamic with some of these seafood plants? And that people are making more money sitting at home in front of a television than actually going to work. So you have a hard time finding the right labor.
It's something that needs to be looked at for sure, because you do have people that lost their jobs that don't want to go back to doing that right now because of the funds that are coming in for them. And on the other side of that too, though, you have the people that have lost their job and then want to go back to work and want to get back in the market and have tried and tried and tried to get unemployment benefits from the state and have struggled with that. I mean, a case in particular, I had an individual that constituent of mine that called me, this is several weeks ago, that had lost his job prior to the pandemic, and put him in the system. He got one check, and then they booted him out. And when he finally was able to get a hold of someone, they told him, oh, well, you were unemployed prior. We're only going to deal with people that lost their jobs during the pandemic. I mean, things like that, that's not right. I think
that's not what
you can't prepare. So the Labor Department couldn't prepare for a pandemic. I mean, that's just what you can't prepare for that.
They really were overwhelmed by this.
Oh, wow. Well, we were 5 weeks in, and they're still trying to stand up a call center. I mean, things like that shouldn't have happened, in my opinion.
So, is that something you guys got to look at? I mean, we might talk about this maybe later in the segment, but that, you know, all the focus seems to be on taking executive power away from the governor or from the state health officer and maybe reining that in somewhat where the legislature has more of a role in it. But some of these institutions, some of these agencies that didn't function as well as they could have, is there anything that the legislature could do on that end to, like, maybe bolster it or make it better or make it function better?
I think so. I think it's worth taking a look at. I mean, one of the things that, you know, my background, I come from a strategic planning, you know, military side background, and you while you can't plan for every possible event, I mean, you need to have in the works, if this happens, what will we do? How will we stand up a call center in so many days? How will we bring in extra staff? How will we, I mean, things like requiring individuals, I had people from my district that were driving to Montgomery and camping out all day in the parking lot at the Labor Department hoping to be seen. You know, get there at 6 a.m. and they're still number 200 in line. That's not right. That is absolutely not right. That's things that you need to have a plan on. How do you deal with things regionally in each congressional district? And so I think things like that, along with executive power, will be looked at, and it will definitely be looked at in February when we go in session.
Yeah, that one is it seems like a huge sore spot for a lot of people. The money was there. It was just a matter of getting the money in the right hands and distributing it. And it clearly, you know, obviously you can't plan for a pandemic. No one saw this coming. But, you know, all this focus on good times and making good times even better, we never war gamed that worst case scenario.
That's right. And you know, you have to, I think one of the first things you do is you look at what plans are there. What do we do in North Alabama when there's a tornado and people lose their livelihood for a couple of months? How do we help them? So why can't we take that type practice and expand it statewide and look at all of those things. I mean, because the thing is, as elected official, it's our job to look after those guys, in my opinion, to focus on the people that lost their job and are losing their job, and to not make it more difficult for them to get their compensation, but make it where it's easier for them to get their compensation, get back on their feet, and make a livelihood for themselves and for their family.
But it's even like, you know, a lot of people compare this to hurricane response, and we've never seen something like this, you know. But the best thing we could compare it to are some of the hurricanes, or the BP oil spill is another one. These are all things that you would have to deal with,
right?
You know, or should they ever happen again. Do you get the sense, though, that, you know, that there's something that could be learned from those experiences in the past, that is how you respond to a disaster, not what is going on right now.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head there, Jeff. I mean, one of the things that you do in planning is you look at what's worked, what hasn't worked, and then develop plans. And they need to be flexible plans, not so rigid where, okay, well, we're doing this statewide, but we're not seeing the unemployment issues in one part of the state, or we're not seeing, you know, whatever the issue is. But you have to be able to adapt and to think on the spot. And I just think in a lot of instances we haven't seen that. And I think that, you know, that's one of the things we definitely have to look at and change for in the future, because these kind of events, while albeit rare, they do happen. And, you know, it's going to happen again. I mean, it may be next year, it may be 100 years from now, but at some point, this type of situation is going to reoccur.
Yeah, where you got to have people stay at home, and you know, the schools and the education system, all of that. Because typically government is very reactive; they're not proactive. Do you get the sense that we'll be reacting to this for some time?
At least through the November election.
But even beyond that, I think there's a money to be spent or whatever that you,
oh, yeah,
can, you know, you could politicize this. Do you want this to happen again? And people will make more of this as a political wedge in the future.
Definitely. I mean, I think you're seeing this right now becoming, now, if you had asked me a year ago what would be the top issue in the presidential race, no one could have dreamed this. But, you know, coming in, I was listening to the radio, and, you know, it was the Democrats hammering President Trump. And, that's becoming their issue.
All right, we're going to take a quick timeout. We got one more segment with State Representative Chip Brown, so stay tuned for that. This is the Jeff Poore Show on FM Talk 106.5.
The poets tell how Poncho fell and left his living in a cheap hole.
And welcome back to the Jeff Poore Show on FM Talk 106.5. So good to be with you on this Tuesday morning, almost afternoon. Coming up tomorrow on the program, real quick rundown, Heritage Foundation's Han von Spakowski. We're talking about mail-in voting, all the pitfalls of that. Also, State Senator David Sessions, looking forward to that. And what will be our usual Wednesday guest, Yellowhammer News' Sean Ross. We'll get caught up on things. My editor at Yellowhammer News, not only do I host a radio show, I write for Land Yap and Breitbart, but Yellowhammer News as well. So make sure you go check out yellowhammernews.com. Still with us for the remainder of the program is State Representative Chip Brown, represents District 105. Representative, the you might be tired of talking about face mask mandates and all of that, but I think it's just a bigger question. People kind of want to know. There's going to be a push to roll back some of this authority in these circumstances. What is that right balance where you don't take away too much of the governor's ability to act to certain circumstances, but you do want something in place to make sure that there's no overreach or it's not abused?
Well, you know, I think we're finding out what that balance is. I mean, one of the things down here on the coast we have to be careful about and keep in mind is that hurricanes and that ability for the governor to declare a state of emergency for this area regarding hurricanes. Because if you think back, Hurricane Frederick, Hurricane Ivan, Katrina, I mean, some of those lasted weeks, months. I mean, I remember as a child, Hurricane Frederick, I didn't go to school for weeks, and, you know, we didn't have power. I think we didn't have power for Frederick, at least a month.
For months, some people.
Yeah. That's right. And so that's hard to explain to people that aren't from the coast, you know. And from a safety standpoint, you have to balance that, too, after hurricanes with looting and that sort of thing. But I do think we really need to take a look at authority and what's the right balance. And what's the role of the state health officer in regards to being able to do mandates regarding health, masks, school closures, that sort of thing. I mean, what is his role? Because he is not a constitutionally elected individual.
No, he's appointed by a group of doctors that in some cases lobby you guys in the legislature, right? So, I mean, that kind of rubs people the wrong way because we pay taxes. We didn't vote for these mandates.
That's right.
What point, you know, I guess there's going to have to be something put in place, but that sounds like overhauling an entire system.
Well, I think it is definitely going to happen. I mean, it's definitely going to be looked at, but you have to remember, too, at the end of the day, the governor has the veto power. So,
yeah, but you can override a veto in the Alabama legislature pretty easily.
But, you know, it's going to be looked at, and it's going to be looked at from a power standpoint because, I am not a fan of big government. I'm not a fan of big government mandates. And really, if you look at the Alabama legislature, there's 77 Republicans in the legislature, and I can't speak for everyone, but we're a conservative state, and I think we're definitely going to look at that for sure.
But the goal would be, to me, it seems like giving that power to the locals. They know the situation in their communities. You have to anticipate they're going to act responsibly, and they're going to do the right thing for their communities. But there just seems at the state level that, well, maybe we're not quite willing to trust the locals here. Is that
on an issue like, let's say, mask mandates, for example? I mean, you have parts of Alabama that, you know, everyone's been affected by the COVID-19 pandemic, but you have certain areas that are hotspots and certain areas that aren't. So I think you need to. I think you're taking the right approach where you look at what's right for you know, Huntsville may not be right for slap out Alabama.
Right, right. Oh, we got to leave it there. I want to thank you for joining us. We'll do it again real soon. Guys, I got to get out of here. As always, you will stay tuned for Midday Mobile with the one and only Sean Sullivan. Woo! This has been the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5.